Welcome to the Podcast Maneuver, the officially unofficial podcast for Picard on CBS. I'm Jim.
I'm Lieutenant Commander Aaron.
Oh, shit, I'm Ensign Jim.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I need a gray jumpsuit.
It's a good thing I'm an... We're in the wrong seat. You're the android. You should be sitting at Ops.
Yeah, you're right.
Oh, well.
I'm also the one who looks most like Will Wheaton.
I mean, they promoted Geordi right from helmsman to chief engineer, so, like... Who knows? Yeah. We'll see. Have to see at season two. You might end up being Admiral.
I will get that fucking hat. I will jump up so high like you've never seen.
You will get that hat. You'll snatch it.
I will. We're going to talk about season one, episode one of Picard. We watched it. How many times have you seen this thing? Because I've seen it a lot now.
I have seen it multiple times. I would say as many as two.
I've seen it as many as three.
It was positronically cloned in my mind, so There's now two copies of it. I threw explosive acid at one, but yeah, I'm ready to play.
Okay, cool. We're gonna do this as a full recap podcast. At least this episode. Who knows what will happen in the future? Maybe the Negaverse Jim will get some half-assed podcast going.
Yeah, we'll have to do it thematically rather than scene by scene.
We'll see. So what were your feelings on the return of Picard, or the return of, you know, Captain Jean-Luc Picard?
I am a very old school Star Trek fan. I mean, I'm only 43, so I guess I'm not that old school, but my dad is a big fan of the old series, and I liked the Star Trek movies, and I was very excited in, I think, fifth grade is when Star Trek The Next Generation came out. And I loved having a show about space with cool ships, and I got into the novelizations, and it made me into a giant Star Trek fan that kind of only died out halfway through Voyager. Mm-hmm. I still watch all the Star Trek movies that come out, and I at least give, when Disco came out, I watched a couple episodes and confirmed that, yep, this is still not my Star Trek. So I was... originally elated when I saw them wanting to come out with Star Trek Picard, because Picard's my favorite captain, and Star Trek the Next Generation is my favorite era, and they were talking about having this be a return to, like, the Star Trek of yore, you know, with maybe some more focus on positivity, exploration, I don't know. And then when I got found more and more about it, and I found out how much of the creative team is shared between Star Trek Disco and Picard, I got a little bit disenchanted, and I thought, oh, this is going to be very action hero, you know, Star Trek. It's going to be very new Trek, where it's all blowing and explosions and lens flares. And I was very pleasantly surprised at how good this first episode of Picard was, Remembrance. It's very nostalgia heavy, made my inner Trek fan smile a lot. I got a little choked up in a couple of scenes. I thought it was a very, very good way to launch this franchise. It's not quite the return to Roddenberry optimism or even anything close to it.
No.
But it's probably what it needs to be an interesting and engaging Star Trek in 2020.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed because of how television has changed. You know, everybody's doing serialized stuff. You're not going to get this sort of adventure of the week with a loose sort of connecting thread between a few of the episodes. You're going to get this very connected thing that's going to explore fewer themes. Like, that's the thing that struck me about The Next Generation and the difference between that and the shows that came after, with the exception of maybe Voyager, you always had like a theme that you were exploring every week, right? It was about like, oh, how hard is it to be a parent? Or what is it like to fall in love as a teenager? Or like, how do we deal with the violation of our own principles?
How do you judge the laws and customs of another alien culture?
Yeah, and it seems like they're going to have, you know, some pretty heady themes about, you know, artificial intelligence and what that means as far as, like, is this a life form? Should we give it the same rights? What happens when it rebels and tries to destroy us? Things like that. But you're not going to get the broadness that, like, The Next Generation had, which... Yeah. To me, is what makes The Next Generation interesting, and it's just a side effect of how we tell stories now.
Yeah, and I wonder if they can, because, like, it's funny when you said that, like, you know, you need to be this episodic type of thing or serialized type of thing, and I was thinking about how much success The Witcher had, which was kind of like the X-Files, where you had like a monster of the week that Geralt was going around and fighting and solving and decursing. But there's also this narrative thread that was introduced in characters, and it's kind of a blend of the two.
Yeah.
Very similar to kind of, I guess, the first season of Justified, which was kind of like Gangster of the Raylan investigating Gangster of the Week. But there's also episodes that had this continuity. And I wondered if, I don't know. I'd be interested. I don't know how this first season of Picard is going to go.
Right.
Whether they have in mind like a 2 or 3 season arc with this investigation of this biological robots that Data was getting up to. I don't know how it'll go, but like maybe that's something they could try too, because it seems like there's some shows that are trying to like bridge the best of those worlds, where, you know, the best of both worlds,
mm-hmm.
where you can have the episodic kind of like more free form, you know, unstructured, throw your characters in a bunch of new crazy situations, as well as build those character arcs and still have their very satisfying things that you can only do over the course of years and years of audience engagement. I don't know if they could do it, but I'd like to see them experiment with it.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, Star Trek Next Generation, I've been rewatching old episodes of that lately, and mm-hmm. just hugely nostalgic, and it has to do with, I'm just so glad that Next Generation came out in an era when that was possible, and that was actually kind of the sort of rule of the day, is like you do all of these very loosely connected episodes,
mm-hmm.
because, and also, honestly, I'm glad it came out when it did, because I was a kid, and I felt like a lot of these thematic explorations were very new to me, mm-hmm. things that I had only ever considered on a surface level, if at all. Also, you had 24-ish episodes a season back then, and I don't think the Next Generation withered under that pace. I think there are some bad parts of Next Generation. There are some slow series of episodes, but for the most part, it was able to maintain 24 episodes a season and tell some really strong stories.
And it had so many.
And so I just get more of it, right? Like,
yeah.
Nowadays it would have been a 10 episode or shorter run per season. We'd have like 30 episodes. No, we have like 150 episodes or something of Star Trek,
right.
Next Generation. It's
right.
It's great.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about this format is, like, you know, we talked a lot when we were covering Rick and Morty about how open-ended that series is you could tell any story that you want. You could tell a story out of Game of Thrones. You could tell a story out of Back to the Future. You could tell a story out of Fast Times at Ridgemont High if you wanted to. Star Trek has a lot of that, because with the holodeck, with the ability to visit different planets, with the ability to time travel, you know, if you want to have like some fan servicey episode where the crew is fucking around in a holodeck, absolutely can do that. If you want to go back in time and explore alternate history, you can do that. If you want to see a planet where there's the women are the dominant species and the men are just the less than underclass, you can do that.
Yeah.
And that's such a strength that it feels like Star Trek is largely abandoned in favor of whatever they've been doing for the last 2 decades. you know, and
action.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe we should get into the episode. We've had our say on a lot of how this compares to Next Generation, and I think it'll be interesting moving forward to see how that goes.
Housekeeping.
A little bit of housekeeping first. HBO comes out of the gate of the new year strong with their crazy, sexy, cool series on Vatican politics, The New Pope. Episodes drop on Monday on HBO, and Jim, Cecily, and I make a new trinity of podcasters to cover all the intercourse and intrigue on Wednesdays. Search for New Pope Who Dis on your favorite podcast app or aggregator to listen and subscribe. Each week, Jim and I check out a new or classic movie on the Bald Movies feed, so subscribe and you won't miss anything. This week, we'll be checking out Groundhog Day, the movie, as a kickoff for our fabulous annual Groundhog Day 24-hour charity stream. That's right, we're doing a 24-hour-long charity stream on twitch.tv/baldmove starting at noon this Friday, January 31st, with all net proceeds going to raise money for the Australian Red Cross to give relief for the bushfires that have been ravaging the continent. Make a note of the new start date. It starts this noon, this Friday, January 31st. We're running until the following noon on Saturday, February 1st. We're in the Eastern U.S. time zone, so check your schedules. But honestly, it's a 24-hour stream. It's a pretty big target to hit. We'll be watching disaster movie after disaster movie nonstop on twitch.tv/baldmove, including such classics as Twister, 2012, Armageddon, Volcano, and The Day After Tomorrow. We'll be doing a prize giveaway sometime during each film. If you want more details, follow us
at Bald Move on your favorite social media site. Check our forums or baldmove.com itself. Please stop by, say hi, hang out, and if you can, give to help out our friends and neighbors down under.
Let's start with the recap. We start off with Picard playing poker with Data, and Mars explodes outside the window of the Enterprise of 10 forward there. Picard then wakes up in his vineyard. This was all a dream. He's on Chateau Picard in France. And we get a lot of... So it starts right away with the callbacks, right? Mm-hmm. I know this Ella Fitzgerald song, Blue Skies, is I think what Data sang at Riker's
and Troy's wedding.
Yeah, wedding. Riker and Troy's wedding.
And Nemesis.
I've only seen that movie once because it wasn't good.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't have a good memory of that, which is unfortunate because I know a lot of the events that take place in that are directly referenced in this episode.
I might have to bite the bullet this weekend and watch Star Trek Nemesis.
I might.
I've been wanting to anyway. I'm like, I had this idea. I was like, man, maybe I should go back and watch the quote unquote bad Star Treks, like 1, 3, 5,
Insurrection,
just to see like how are they as bad as I thought. But yeah, like it's this thing, and like, you know, Picard playing poker with Data. We know that's something that Picard really never did until the very last episode of the series, where the events of All Good Things led him to think, you know what, maybe keeping these emotional walls between me and my bridge crew for these years hasn't been, like, I had good reasons for doing it, but maybe it's not the best approach for me as the human Picard. And like the idea that he, you know, would continue to do that in his dream states, and the tell of Data. When I watched it a second time, actually, they actually did animate his left pupil.
They did, yeah.
And Data doing the deadpan like sense of humor is like, well, since you pointed out my tell, Captain, I don't know which deception to employ. He goes right back to the Princess Bride's, you know, duel with, what is it? Not Fezzik, Fizzini.
I don't
Vizzini,
know the names.
You know, it's like, oh, I just thought that was really funny and how well they kind of fell into that dynamic. Mm-hmm.
And they're establishing a little bit of the themes here, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that, like, when Data asks him, you know, why he's stalling or whatever, he says, I don't want the game to end. And I think that's Picard realizing he's approaching the end of his life. He's kind of been sitting out all these years. Like, that's festering in his mind, and it comes to a head later. Yeah. But, yeah, there's some themes of mortality, themes of maybe nostalgia, too, but those are kind of linked.
Yeah. Plus... speaking of nostalgia, just seeing this Galaxy class starship just glide through these just jaw dropping vistas in space was really just really hit the Trek nerd in me just so. I like it.
And then
a lot.
When he wakes up and he calls his dog Number One,
yeah.
I about lost it. Riker was always a bit of a dog to begin with.
Yeah, he sure was a
so
dirty
fitting.
Dog. Dirty dog going from port to port, from starbase to starbase. I like it. I think, I don't know if I actually saw this on the show, but like in the promotional material, they show that his identification tag is a Starfleet and communicator insignia.
His ID tag?
Yeah, for the dog.
Oh, the dog. Okay, yeah.
Which I think is really funny. Mm-hmm. But it also introduces a lot of mystery. Like, why is Mars exploding?
Yeah.
Why is he having these recurring nightmares of this destruction? And at first, when I was watching the episode, I'm thinking, oh, this must be, as we find out more about, I want to talk, I guess, take a brief detour into the canon of Star Trek. It appears that they've embraced the J.J. Abrams canon, which is that Romulan's homeworld is destroyed by supernova.
Okay.
That was established in the first Trek reboot. And then the Romulan starship went back in time and started fucking with and destroyed Vulcan and all this other things. They're rolling with that.
Okay.
And it seems like all this stuff kind of took place as more or less how those movies anticipated it. But I wondered if this was just Picard's guilt over, you know, his part or lack of his lack of being able to talk the Federation into doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then it seems like, no, actually, some rogue AI went and blew up Mars in the recent past.
I think those things are tied together in that. It seemed like they were moving the Romulans maybe to Mars, the 900 million they were trying to evacuate. Maybe they were, because the rescue fleet is destroyed in that attack as well.
Yeah.
So they would have had to have been around Mars.
But it's unclear to me whether they were staging all these starships to go do the rescue mission, and then it was blown up before, like, the baby was strangled in the crib, or whether, like you said, suggested they had some success bringing them, and then the AI...
I suppose it could be either, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, and I don't know. I think some of these things are, like, being introduced early on to kind of, like, be the mysteries in the series as we go on.
Yeah, these are the big questions that I have, and I think that's intentional. Then we go over to Boston... on Earth, obviously. A woman named Dodge is having an evening in with her boyfriend to celebrate being accepted to the Daystrom Institute, which should sound pretty familiar to Star Trek Next Generation fans. Some space goons show up to find out where she's from, and they try to capture her, killing her boyfriend in the process, and she manages to instead kill all of them, and then she sees this vision of Picard. We have no idea how they're connected.
Yeah. We don't know it yet, but these are, looks like they're some sort of Romulan faction, because everyone that we see de-helmeted, I was jokingly referring to them in my notes as a Romulan sport bike motorcycle gang.
Yeah.
But we also, it's very unclear to me, like, what the relationship here is and what, if any, affiliation they have with the Romulan faction we see in the Reclamation Zone. Because it seems like they're at odds. One is embracing this biological life. Maybe they don't know. Maybe they don't know the other daughter's nature and whatnot. I have a lot of questions about that, but you're supposed to.
You're supposed to, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the fight choreography was pretty strong in this scene.
Yeah.
You know, in as much as Star Trek is action now, and, you know, has always been a little bit of action, though mostly cheesily done.
Yeah, the linked double fist overhead hammer that apparently is the only combat technique they taught at Starfleet Academy. It's just not going to cut it in the age of what Jason Bourne and John Wick. And
no, when it's that powerful, what do you need with other moves?
It's true.
You just come into a fight, you do that, it's over.
You got a nerve. You got the nerve pinch, and if you're a mere human mortal, then you got the double overhand hammer fist.
Hell yeah. but no, this looked like it was done by a very competent choreography team, stunt team. It looks like they sweated the details on this, because I've seen a lot of bad fights in my time.
Seen a lot of bad fights in Star Trek.
In Star Trek, yeah, even in particular. But this one was pretty good.
Yeah.
Zero complaints.
If you're going to have some action in new Star Trek, you might as well stage it competently.
Yeah. I have no idea still how she is mentally linked to Picard, how she's seeing visions of a man who she apparently doesn't know.
It seems like she has, like, if we're going to go with the fact that she's a constructed, you know, bio machine, that a lot of this stuff is locked away from her.
Just
that
implanted sort of memories.
It reminds me a lot of, like, Jason Bourne, in that he just knows how to do all this stuff, but he doesn't have any conscious control over, at least initially.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of an interesting way to take this. What is Picard's DNA? Because it seems like it's a lot of Star Trek VI, the movie, which revolved around, like, Starfleet being torn between their humanitarian mission and the desire, the pragmatic desire to see their oldest and most bitter adversary die, you know, in a moon explosion. But it also has, I think there's a lot of, like, Jason Bourne in this.
Yeah.
It looks like a Dunkirk got name checked. There's, like, that's definitely, I'm looking at all the creative influences and then also 21st century Earth politics.
Yeah.
Where there's a whole bunch of, like, you know, what is a country's obligation to help another country? Whether they're allies, whether they're enemies, like, at what point do you set aside old rivalries and bitterness and just realize, you know, we're one human race? That seems like that's where a lot of the creative juices are flowing in this direction.
Yeah, and I think that the pairing of, like, Picard's desire to help these Romulan refugees with the artificial intelligence question about whether that is life or not is a good pairing, because that interview later on in the episode where Picard's asked, like, about that mission, and he says, well, there were 900 million lives, and she says Romulan lives, and he says, no, lives. I mean, you go back and you look at some of the stuff that happened in Next Generation around Data and his, you know, sentience or lack thereof, the battle over that. And you start to understand that Picard views life as a very all-encompassing sort of thing, right? It's not a matter of, like, which faction you're a part of or anything like that. He has a value, an intrinsic, he places an intrinsic value on life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a good blending of those two things, because we're going to see an enemy and someone who wasn't traditionally an enemy, the AI, but has sort of made themselves into that in the minds of the humans.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Especially since with artificial life, there's always the so with human life, you have humans and they reproduce and they make more humans. No one would say that, like, if you gave birth to a child, that child is literally no longer human. I don't know. Maybe we'll have one of those crossover events with genetic engineering and AI meshing in the future. But so far, two humans get together to make another human.
Yeah.
It's an open question if Data were to reproduce and make another, a daughter or a son or whatever, is that you can make artificial intelligence that are not sentient, that are not human.
Mm-hmm.
Like a different robotic scientist could make an artificial form of life that is nothing like Data. Would you grant it full sentience and rights as a Federation member? There's a lot of questions that don't come up in when you're talking about humanity that do kind of can come up with when you're talking about artificial intelligence. And even, mm-hmm. He mentions that in this interview you're referring to that there's never a time where he doubted Data, but I just recently watched season 3 through 5 of The Next Generation, and Data got hijacked by some alien or external influence 6 different times and took over the Enterprise, almost killed the crew as a result of this. That's a unique vulnerability that he had that, I don't know, it seems like everybody got took turns possessed by some alien creature by the end.
Yeah.
But, it's... It'll be interesting to see how they continue to explore the differences between artificial life and non-artificial life, and if those differences are meaningful, and how do you judge each artificial life form on its own merits.
Mm-hmm. And then we get the theme song for the show, which I don't know about you, but I have not really felt any of the theme songs since maybe Voyager was the last one that I thought was remarkably Star Trek. Everything since TNG has started to feel a little more sad, a little softer, a little more confused. There's nothing as bold as the TNG
it's Muzak
melody.
It's Star Trek Muzak.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, if it's too many instruments being combined or the melody just isn't strong enough or bold enough to hold up the entirety of it, but
right.
TNG is a extremely memorable theme song.
The old series, holy shit.
The original series, extremely memorable.
Yeah.
I had to go look up what even Deep Space Nine sounded like. Deep Space Nine, which I've watched the entirety of twice, I couldn't think of the theme song
because
it's just not as memorable. It's not as bold.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as uplifting. I think that's one of the things that Star Trek's been missing for a while, is that sense of hope.
I was wondering if they would do a TNG reworking for the theme song of this.
They put a tiny little flare of it at the end.
Did you think so?
I think they also did with Disco, but
I was listening for it, and I was watching it with Cecily the first time, and she mentioned that she thought she heard. I thought they'd maybe even lean more heavily into that.
Yeah, they really don't until the very, very tail end of it.
Hmm.
But yeah, I'm a little disappointed that it wasn't something more bold, more declarative. But then we go to Chateau Picard again, and Jean-Luc walks with his dog, and then he returns to the house where his assistants prepare breakfast for him and prep him for an interview that he's agreed to. And this interviewer sits down with him and breaks her promise not to talk about the event leading up to his resignation from Starfleet. And in typical, I think, in the captain they remember form, Picard tells them why he defends his actions, and then he ends the interview.
I thought this scene was good, but I was kind of surprised the way they framed it doesn't give Picard a lot of agency. He's just going to grant this interview, but he doesn't want it to go in this one spot that it seems like he would want it to go to. Why would Picard want to carry the weight of the Federation or a Starfleet that he no longer thinks is living up to its original mission? Mm-hmm. I almost wish they'd frame this after 20 or whatever years of silence, retired Admiral Jean-Luc Picard breaks the silence on the Federation because of something that was happening around the galaxy, and he just rips him a new one. Like he was goaded into it, or he was like, oh, my back's cornered, I can't do anything but shit on the Federation. I don't know. I would have liked to seen him kind of like, you know what? I picked my spot. I've waited. And now the Federation has done something to really stick their dick into mashed potatoes. And I'm coming out and I'm blasting them. I'm blasting them about how they turned their back on AI research. And I'm blasting about the treatment of the Romulan refugees. But he feels like he got like, all right, I'll come and appear in your show as long as we don't talk about anything that's actually important to me.
Yeah.
And I thought that's weird. It's like, that's, you know, Picard's a man of action. He doesn't mind. He's very much for civility and decorum, but he will get in and turn over your apple cart if you let him.
Absolutely. Picard would have when he was in Starfleet. But I get the impression that this is a man who, there's a line in there where he wakes up from a dream and he says, I haven't been living. I've been waiting to die.
Right.
And I feel like that is the difference, right? He was sort of, like, he quits Starfleet, and maybe he does go give a couple of talks on how shitty Starfleet's become, how they're not the Starfleet he remembers. But over the last few years, he's sort of been pushing that out of his life, right? And living this life that is very sedate, that is very off the radar. He doesn't take part in that stuff. But I could see absolutely if he caught wind of an event that Starfleet was responsible for or participated in that made him sort of rekindle that desire in him to speak out. Mm-hmm. That would have been a really cool way to go.
Yeah.
I don't think it's awful the way they went. But perhaps it could have been a little better.
I also think that I think it's interesting what there's a lot of mystery about, like, why the synthetics, you know, how many synthetics were there?
Yeah.
What capacity were they being used by the Federation? It makes it seem like they just kind of went berserk and attacked, but like maybe I forget what the faction of Chakotay belonged to.
The Maquis.
No. Yeah. Wasn't it the Maquis?
I thought that was Deep Space Nine. That was the.
That's the Jim Bajoran. Hadar.
No, I thought that was a Bajoran underground.
Mm. But, you know, there's been a couple of separatist factions where they don't agree with what the Federation is doing and they're fighting against it. But they had it like, you know, Chakotay wasn't an evil guy. He was definitely like, you know, Star Trek insurrection style. But
he,
you know, was fighting against the Federation. And I wonder if you properly understood the androids, the synths motivations, if you would be more sympathetic to them. But they're not around. What happened to them all? Were they hunted down to extinction?
Right. Are there Blade Runners in this universe? Is that what these...
Blade Runner, the next generation.
I mean, there would have to be, right? Because you have a rogue faction, which they clearly say is a rogue faction of synths.
Mm-hmm.
That implies that there are many more of them. What do they do? Just shut them down? Do they let them live their lives out? Like, their lives are forever. They won't go away.
Yeah.
So, I do have a lot of logistical questions about what it means to ban AI when AI already exists.
I also wonder what he meant by it was Dunkirk, because what is that, other than the fact that that was a very popular movie that they're name checking a historical event that happened almost 500 years in Picard's past? Because that was literally a group of men who were pinned between the sea and an oncoming human threat. Is he putting the supernova in the place of the Nazis, or is that what it was? Because I was also wondering.
He was the captain on the, you know, fishing boat headed over to rescue people,
and then all the robots came to sink him. I was just wondering, but was there any way to frame were the AI the ones that were against the anvil and the hammer, or you know?
I thought it was the Romulans.
He didn't explain what he meant by what was Dunkirk. So
he just gave her shit for. Maybe not knowing, he just assumed that she had no idea what Dunkirk
is. I think you're right, because
the
logical inference, you had this ragtag fleet of people trying to save other people from a doomed, situation. Mm-hmm. But I was hoping that he would actually maybe connect the lines exactly what he meant by that.
I noticed that Captain Picard now in his old age is drinking decaf.
Earl Grey. Light.
Tea, Earl Grey, decaf.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so he doesn't want to get too excited this early in the morning. Also, the other thing, the costuming is so good. Like, one of the hilarious things about the TNG is, like, to see, like, what they came up with future designs. Uh-huh. These things, I thought, like, Picard looked dapper as fuck throughout the entire episode.
Especially when he goes to Daystrom. I thought that suit was really cool.
Yeah, I like the, like, there's this really complicated tie he had going on in the first one with like a little collarless suit ensemble. Like, it felt like, okay, this is 500 years of Earth fashion. It's kind of drifted, but you still got the basics, and the basic colors are still. Yeah. I thought the sense of fashion was pretty good.
I'm just waiting until the day I can just wear a jumpsuit, just wear the same jumpsuit every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be happy.
Just get a Star Trek style pajamas. Get some boots, and you're good to go.
Yeah, it wouldn't look weird. okay, let's move on to Picard relaxing on his chateau. When Daj shows up, having seen his interview to tell him what happened and find out if he knows anything about her, and they sit down later that evening to talk, and he examines the necklace that she's wearing, which is these sort of two rings. She says she knows him, and he somehow seems to know her, though they can't place it, and he invites her to stay the night.
I remember thinking when I was watching, it's like, how in the world are they going to pay this off? How are they going to explain his, like, connection to her and her connection to him?
I don't think they fully have.
They
I think
don't,
it's
but
like
if that's a painting that he had looked at in his ready room,
yeah,
like, you know, but hadn't seen it for 10, 15 plus years or however long it's been, like, that explains from, because her perspective, it's easy. If she's a synthetic, then she had all these routines hidden in her, like, hey, you know, when the shit hits the fan, here's how you judo Romulan dudes, and here's the man you can trust above all else. That makes sense, but like Picard, what, you know, did Data or Bruce Maddox or whoever hijack the neural shit that the Borg left behind there and burn in her face? But the painting was a very...
The painting makes sense.
And yeah. They also kind of, it's like, because then I was like, well, how the hell would Data know? But they kind of intimated that Maddox might have based her face. If this Bruce Maddox guy, who is this, we'll probably talk about him here in a bit, but if he based her face on that painting that he made of, you know, that makes a lot of sense.
And she could... So is she literally like a clone of Data, just a female version of Data, well, cloned from one of his neurons?
I thought that the doctor at the Daystrom Institute that he talked Maddox. To implied that all synths were essentially manufactured from Data's positronic network.
Well,
like that was like the core code that they used. And once Data died, they were unable to make any more. And then the researchers banned altogether. So I think every one of those synths that went crazy for Mars and this woman, these two women, they're all share some kind of neural similarities to Data. And then they have some pretty out there, like they mentioned that, like, if you have a single positronic neuron, you could reconstitute some essence of Data. That's kind of wild and out there, but hey, you know.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, Data's been in it already, so it wouldn't surprise me to see him come back in some cloned form.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Yeah. What'd you think of Brent Spiner's makeup? Because
it was good. It was good. I mean, he's older. Like,
yeah.
He's obviously much older, but like for the most part, they nailed it.
No, I thought they did a really good job at de-aging him, because I know that's one thing that he said after Nemesis. He doesn't want to play Data anymore because he's aged out of the role. Like, Data shouldn't age. And
he back into it with CG. Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's crazy, you know?
But I thought that his eyes were really weird. I'm like, this is not how Data looks, but I think it's the lighting. Because when I watched Generations, there was a couple which has kind of like more Hollywood dark subdued lighting than the television show. There was a couple uncanny valley instances where when the shadow hit his face just right, those super pale eyes just jump out. Where when he's brightly lit and they kind of fade into the background of his kind of gold off-white skin and the beige corridors of the Enterprise, it doesn't jump out. So like after I watched it a couple more times, I'm like, I think this is how Data looked. It's just we're not used to seeing him with mood lighting.
Sure. That makes sense.
But it was jarring. Like every time those, like when he was in those situations and his pale yellow eyes are just like shining, it's pretty wild.
So then we go to the dream, speaking of Data, where he's painting a portrait in the vineyard. Data invites Picard to finish the painting, and Picard says, I don't know how to do that. And Data says, that's not true. You absolutely do. And he wakes to find that unfinished painting, or painting from a different perspective. It looks like she's maybe turned more toward the sea.
Yeah, she's looking behind her.
Something. You can't see her face in this particular copy.
Yes.
But that painting is hanging in his study. And they find out that Daj has left during the night. I feel like we've talked a good deal about that, so we'll probably move on to the next scene, where Picard goes to the Starfleet archives to find the other copy of the painting in storage, which includes the face of the woman in the portrait, which looks very much like Daj, identical. He verifies that no one has messed with this painting, which was painted by Data, and finds out also that the title is Daughter. I really, really liked this scene. It inspires so many questions about future archival. And recall of that kind of stuff, that it just had my head spinning because, like, there's a lot of nostalgia stuff in here, which is great. This Captain Picard day is fantastic. That's one of the old TNG episodes where the kids make up this poster for him, or this banner. There are a lot of models around here that you see on set in his ready room and in his quarters and stuff throughout TNG.
They stored the corpse of his lionfish that's been floating dead for...
Did they?
No. But it'd been funny if they did.
But then the most interesting thing to me is when he calls up this painting, because there's so much going on here. So these archives, in my mind, are teleporting things out of storage into his own personal, like, lockbox kind of room. Like you would do with a safe deposit box in a bank. And it comes with a cover. Like I was trying to determine, is this teleporting something physical from a physical space into this room, or is this simply a transporter pattern buffer that's being replicated in front of him?
Yeah, I had a question too, just in I wasn't teleporting, it was more of like, why don't they just scan? It'd be one thing if it's like the Mona Lisa or something that's like super culturally important. But like if it's just some random banner that some children finger painted 30 years ago, why don't they just scan that and then disassemble it and replicate it when needed?
Like, yeah, I mean, Picard's always been a bit of a stickler for having physical books. Like,
they can never get caviar just right.
Right. I mean, he carried around Shakespeare books all the time. And
sure.
Like, yeah, he's got physical items, but specifically this painting, because it is teleported, right? Is it created in front of him?
Was it?
Yeah, because he goes up, he walks up to this, like, I don't know, drafting table or something, and he hits a couple buttons and the thing materializes in front of him. And then it's got this crazy cover where he presses a button and it sort of pulls itself off of the painting and stacks itself
I guess I forgot that it materialized in front of him. Because if it does that, then why does it need the fancy box?
But exactly, and the cloth on top of it.
You're right. It must have a physical... It must be like a giant physical thing that they can retrieve via teleportation.
But why would you do that?
Yeah.
If you are willing as a 24th century human
still 24th,
step into a transporter and be teleported somewhere, why would you have any physical attachment to things like that? Wouldn't you just simply carry around like a thumb drive or whatever with all of your
stuff,
possessions on it, and then just replicate it when you
want
needed
it,
this stuff?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, if they're doing that, there must be some kind of like crazy collector community, right? Can you imagine, like,
yeah,
this has never been reconstituted. This has never been teleported or de-atomized, whatever.
Original molecular.
Never gone through the process.
Yeah.
How much? But
did they
do
this like every ensign that washes out of Star Trek or the Starfleet? Did they have like a storage, a digital storage shed that the Federation maintains, or is it just important people like Admiral Picard?
Right.
But even then, it's like
maybe he gets the room with the physical stuff in it, but the ensign would just get a digital locker.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if that's. That's because, the storage of the digital pattern would take up a lot less space than the shitty painting that the Data made, or the Picard Day banner or whatever.
And I, as a collector myself, I'm wondering about the collector community.
His Tux Umat or whatever. Beta Zed for, what was it? Risen fertility symbol that Riker had him get? I forget. What all's in there?
And then you've got the tech that I think we see first in Voyager, which is sort of holographic people.
Mm-hmm.
This archivist, is this librarian of sorts, is clearly a hologram.
Do you think there is ever like a Starfleet figure, like an Admiral Howard Hughes, that like stores just gallons of his own piss and fingernail clippings and whatnot
in his room,
in the archives, because he can't bear to part with it?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are a few, like...
That'd be a weird Admiral.
If Picard were less mentally strong after his Borg incident, that would have been him. They bust him out of the Borg thing. He just says, hand me my jaw.
Yeah.
Hand me my jaw, number one.
I must conserve all my precious bodily fluids. What, the Borg got their hands on them. Damn it, Will.
Couldn't you just store people as pattern buffers? Like, why... Like, I would want to live... I would want you to bust me out once every 10 years for, like, a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I just live my life that way.
So I have an answer from the Star Trek The Next Generation technical manual.
Really?
Yeah. Matter replication happens at like an atomic resolution, whereas people teleporting gets done at the quantum resolution. And so like they actually, I guess, scan the internal quantum state of all your the electrons and the constituents of your neutrons and...
With their Heisenberg
protons and all that stuff, and that's like because like a living being, you can't like if you just replicated it would be dead. Like if you take a living being and replicate it, it's dead. If you transport full quantum resolution, then they're still alive.
So store the quantum resolution image.
It's like, too much space.
Too much space. They can do it for five people at a time on the Enterprise computer.
Got a buffer. You got to clear that buffer out.
Got endless planets out there. Put these fucking things on Saturn. It'll
also,
be fine.
Anytime they needed to like recall an earlier teleportation of Picard, they could always go through the pattern buffer. Yeah, I kept
O'Brien. Maybe the secrets died with O'Brien. He knew how to
do it. Maybe O'Brien's run a whole bunch of like considered unethical teleportation chief research.
Yeah, he was storing that directly in Data's brain.
Yeah,
it was the only way they could do it.
Because Data's brain had like 10 times the space the Enterprise computer. That's the one thing that you get when you look at the technical manuals. Like, no one had any idea what was coming with computing and the internet.
No,
they had no. Like, they were trying to come up with, well, what will floppy disks look like in the 24th century? And
they'll be plexiglass.
Yeah,
they'll be acrylic.
They'll be isolinear chips, and they'll be this and that. It's like, well, in the future, there won't be physical media. You'll just beam everything through hyperspace internet, and you'll have Wikipedia and.
Yeah, no personal physical media.
Right.
It'll all be housed somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, hey, you can't see the future. It turns out
it's true. Also, I found it a little weird that Picard doesn't remember the title of this painting, though it was painted and gifted to him by Data. Is that something he's forgotten because it's just not that important?
You just
of a
don't
thing,
know how
or...
many paintings Data gave to Picard. It was like every three days. Like I call this one Ferengi teeth, Captain. It's a bowl full of Ferengi teeth, and he's like, very good, Data, and he just wads it up and throws it in the archiver.
AKA the Shredder.
All
right, well, let's move on. Dodge calls her mother for help but realizes that her mother knows more than she's letting on, and at the prompting of her mother, Dodge finds Picard again. This time he's at Starfleet. Picard tells her that she might be Data's daughter and that makes her extremely special to him. Unfortunately, her attackers, which we find out are Romulans, return and chase them onto a roof where Dodge is killed in an explosion and Picard is knocked out.
I would pay good money for a VR program that'll allow me to sit on a park bench in the Starfleet headquarters on a very nice day, what it looks like in San Francisco, and have Patrick Stewart hold my hand and say I'm very dear to him and he'll never leave me.
Yeah.
Can we make that happen sometime before Sir Patrick shuffles off this mortal coil?
Just go to Comic-Con 2020. I'm sure he'll be there.
I need to make it happen. Yeah. What is your read? How long has Dodge been active? Because I'm wondering, is she literally like as old as she looks, or was she born like last year and had all these memories flash encoded on her? And this, because like I'm trying to think of like the difficulty, it's almost Truman Show esque if this girl has been active for 20 years or 10 years, like keeping up the appearances of the fact that she's had a complete life, you know, that she was born, that she went through a childhood. Yeah. Like that's got to be tough.
How do you integrate a newborn synthetic into your existing life or their existing life?
Yeah, or maybe they're suggesting she actually was born through some biological process and was written like
possible.
It's an open question how many of these memories, like, because Picard says she rattles off these memories and she has a lot of interesting questions like, oh my God, are you telling me that I'm some soulless machine? He's like, no, God, you should know your dad. He was amazing. He was a cool guy. Took over to Starfleet, almost killed us all a bunch of times, but, you know, you should see me on Earl undecaffeinated Earl Grey. We all get crazy a few times. I got a flute. But I wondered, she also says like, you know, I'm not real. And he has this like kind of beautiful, it's like, you know, no, of course you're real. And you were created with like love and intention, just like any of us are. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was pretty beautiful because especially if you've seen the relevant episodes of Data creating his first child, you know, like what a thoughtful and intentional thing it was. And, you know, he wasn't capable of love, but, you know, tell Bruce Maddox when he was seeing his hands move faster than the human could percept to try to keep his child alive. Like, you know, that's always the interesting thing about Data. It's like he couldn't love until the emotion chip switched on. But
yeah,
it's a shallow reading of Data.
Yeah, and this line about Data being all meaning, I think was interesting in the context of humanity and what us struggling to find our own meaning. Is that the creation of life? Is that something that we would attribute as the final meaning of humanity? I think maybe that's kind of what Picard's getting at there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we may have done that and now that's lost, it's very sad. But it's also a hopeful view of that sadness, which I think is very Star Trek. Do we want to talk about like the reason she's named what she is with this flower? I don't know that they make much of it this episode.
Yeah.
There might be more coming on that.
I don't know, because like Data's first daughter, if these are indeed his daughters, was named Lal, which the episode The Offspring explained to us is like a Sanskrit word for beloved. These characters are named Dodge and Soji, which I'm like, aha, I'm going to go and look up their names. That's going to be apparently these names are relatively meaningless. Like there's no direct equivalent in any human language that I was able to see. There's the relevant words in Sanskrit are like, I think Dodge is like means dowry. And like Soji is some kind of like plant, like essentially saying like wheat flour or something. So unlike the previous names, these appear to have no meaning whatsoever. No more meaning than any of our names have.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Now, you mentioned that you thought that she was named after a flower. I thought it was the other way around, that her whatever memory she had of her father, it was that she this strain of flower he discovered as a xenobotanist or whatever was named after her, but I could have misheard that.
Yeah, I could have too. Don't know which is true. But let's move on to Picard dreaming again. And when he wakes, he tells the assistants that Dodge is dead, which is confusing because none of the police mentioned her and she wasn't on the feeds of the event, apparently using some personal stealth tech. And Picard decides he has to figure out where she came from. And this is where Picard sort of says, like, I haven't been living. I've been waiting to die. It's sounding a little bit like James T. Kirk in Generations. Like, mm-hmm. He wants to matter, right? He wants to do something that changes things. He wants to make his presence in the universe felt.
Yeah, and I don't think it's as like vainglorious as Kirk's, but it's more of kind of like I accuse the Federation of shrinking from its duties and from the galactic stage, but what have I done? I've just been sulking and nursing these old grudges, and it hasn't done anybody any good other than maybe the Romulans that he's taken in. It seems like, his Romulan man and women servants, which is weird, and his giant sprawling chateau. This was a very impressive action sequence. I was genuinely shocked when she got killed. In fact, I immediately suspected there's some kind of trickery.
And there is, but
there might even be trickery on top with this whole, like, if there's just one positronic neural connection left, you can reconstitute some personality. We might not have seen the end of Dodge.
Oh, shit. Could the Borg have it?
I mean, it's always the Borg.
They have his skin, right? Like, maybe also have other parts.
Oh, yeah.
Because they saved that skin.
They got skin samples. They took some positronic sperm samples. They're ready to go over on the Borg side.
And I mean, the Romulans might find it. I don't know what Borg cube they're reclaiming here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But could be something from around Star Trek First Contact era.
Yeah. I thought, so these are, again, all Romulans, as far as we can tell. This is motorcycle gang. I thought it was interesting that, like, is Romulan blood corrosive, or did he have, like, some kind of poison acid tooth? Because it looked like it was fucking his face up, too, this thing he spat at her. And then he also had his gun going critical at the same time. I'm like, this is...
Well, I think the gun went critical because the acid got on it and ate into the power source.
See, I thought he predatored the gun and then spit acid. And I'm like, wow, this is really gilding the lily, man.
It's more like a Terminator thing where if their power source gets damaged, it can cause a massive explosion.
Gotcha. I gotcha.
I actually like this fight scene for the most part. There's one move where she throws a dude down a set of stairs that I thought was amazing.
Yeah, and she also threw him off and threw a dude off of a ledge, and he gets teleported to safety, I think.
Yeah,
he gets teleported as he's in free fall. And of course, I think he also had a knife in his chest at that point. So
okay,
I don't know. It's 24th century, almost a 25th. This is 2399, right?
Is it really?
Wow. Yeah, I think it's like the year before the. I wonder if there's something about like new millennium, new Trek kind of thing that they're doing here too, which is kind of cool.
Could be.
Yeah.
All right, so then Picard visits the Daystrom Institute, where he finds out that they don't have the tech to make a flesh and blood synthetic because they've been prohibited from creating anything at all in physical form after the attack on Mars, only working in theories now. And this scientist explains to him that no one has ever been able to recreate Data, but Bruce Maddock was on to something before they got shut down.
So do you want to?
Now he can't be found.
Do you want to explain who Bruce Maddock is briefly to anyone who might not know?
Yeah, go for it.
So Bruce Maddock was a Starfleet technical officer who got wind of Data early in Data's campaign with the Enterprise. And his position was he wanted to get permission to disassemble Data and study his positronic brain in an effort to make more positronic-brained individuals. And Data was not, I think, in opposition to the idea of creating more of him. He just thought that, like, Bruce Maddock didn't have all of his tech, and it was likely that he would destroy Data in the process of creating him or studying him. Mm-hmm. So Data did not give consent to that procedure. Bruce Maddock then sued Data in Starfleet court and asserted that, you know, Data is essentially property, and Starfleet could do, you know, they claimed him as salvage when they found him abandoned on this planet, and they could do with him whatever he wanted, just like if he was a phaser rifle that they found or a shuttlecraft that they salvaged. There's a whole court case where Picard represented him because that's the foundation of every judicial system, that you have the captain and first officer as...
Sure, yeah. Yeah. No conflict of interest, none whatsoever. Yeah. You have Riker on the other side prosecuting him.
Right, yeah. And then that was a really good episode, despite all the...
It was fantastic. I just watched it again.
The eggs we're throwing at the judicial system.
Season 3, episode 6, Measure of a Man. Or episode 9? I think it's 6.
Was that season 3 or season 2, though? Because the following season, Bruce Maddock comes back when Data is trying to create his daughter, Law. Yeah. And they're more friendly and less adversarial. I think he finally won him over, seeing his fatherly devotion
and
to his offspring.
Kind of mentioned that in this. They say they were sort of friendly, at least, toward the end of the research with synthetics.
It seemed like he was pioneering this fractal neuronic cloning, which is a way to like perfectly duplicate a positronic network, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it creates clones of things, and there's an analogy between the two copies of data. That's where I'm thinking, like, there's more. It's probably not just simple coincidence that Data painted two identical paintings to give to Picard. Like that. Maybe this is. I don't think it's as easy as like Bruce Maddox was just giving. You know, making his face look like Data's painting as a tribute. This feels like it's more something that they were working long term. That was like hush hush, or they were keeping secret.
Yeah, and Picard shows her this necklace, and she tells him all about that and that whole process. And I think Picard, by the end of this, thinks that Maddox may have created these clones, perhaps these synthetics, in Daj and Soji.
So now he knows that Daj wasn't the end. There is, in all likelihood, another individual out there like her that he can find and help, perhaps.
I think we're going to see Maddox come back, because he's kind of out on the lam right now.
Anytime they conspicuously make someone not dead, but also like missing, and you know, also there's a momentous event, the banning of sense, that caused him to kind of like break and take off. Like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I do think this Dr. Jurati, she felt like she was too young to have the career that they talked about her having. But maybe I didn't follow it too well. That, like, I mean, she got recruited right out of Starfleet by Maddox, but how many years ago was that?
It had to be quite... Well, okay, we don't know when synthetics were actually banned. We know when the event happened, like 14 years ago, the uprising.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The attack on Mars happened, so... I think it would be quite a while she's been working, at least maybe 10 years with Maddox.
But this actress kind of baby face too. Like,
she does, yeah.
I was Newsroom 10 years ago. Doesn't look like she's really aged today, so
I don't remember.
Maybe she's 45, 50, and she just doesn't look it. It's the 24th century. People are using moisturizer. People are using
synthetic moisturizer
with built-in sunblock, and they're just not aging like we do nowadays.
It's true. All right. Then after that scene, we go to Romulan space, to a Romulan reclamation site, is what it's called. Mm-hmm. They are reclaiming tech and parts from a Borg cube, and a man named Narek introduces himself to a Dr. Soji Asha, who looks just like Daj and is wearing the same necklace. And then he mentions his sad story about losing his brother, which I'm going to say is a fiction. I don't believe him for a second. And then she invites him to discuss that further.
Yeah. When I first saw Narek walking in, I'm like, okay, who let the Romulan boy band member loose on the Romulan reclamation site? I do not like this guy's kind of look or presentation whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually, then when the scene goes on, I remember that I really liked this actor. He played Victor Frankenstein on Penny Dreadful for several seasons, and I think he's really, really good. So, like, okay, he's got really nice Romulan hair, and he looks like I don't know, maybe he was created in a lab to appeal to this, to quickly gain the trust and confidence of this female synthetic person who they're assuming is straight, apparently. That's their first mistake. Because Data's daughter turns out queer as fuck, and she's not going to have any interest in this this Romulan guy. But I don't know. I what was your first impression of him?
I think he looks like a dirtbag.
Yeah.
And so I automatically attribute some really nefarious shit to him, even though the scene... I can't tell if I'm reading too much into it just based on his appearance, or if the scene wants me to think that something is up here. But clearly... I don't know. This is super interesting to me because it's a kind of an amalgamation of everything that I love about Next Generation. The two big things, the Borg and Data, like this idea of what is a synthetic artificial intelligence to us as humans. What do we do with something like that? What do we make of it? Super fascinating. Some of the best questions in the Next Generation. And then you pair them up with one of the coolest villains of all time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm super happy.
And also, like, I didn't have memories of the Romulans being a huge part. Like, you know, when I think of my childhood love of Star Trek, it's like the Borg.
Yeah.
But, like, the Romulans were the primary antagonist from, like, you know, season three on of the series. And I think it's fascinating to see them... what? So are they squatting on a Borg cube? Is this Borg cube? There's a lot of people arguing about whether this Borg cube is being rebuilt or whether it's being dismantled. Whether this has been like a derelict cube that the Romulans are trying to reconstitute as like some kind of new home world. If the Borg is somehow using the Romulans to, because the Borg, as I understand it, are kind of like destroyed. Like Janeway destroyed them with some kind of nanovirus. So they're just like almost extinct, if not, in fact. Is this some way that the Borg Queen or the Collective is playing some long con game to get reconstituted at the same time as the Romulans? These are all questions I think you're supposed to be asking. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, like seeing all these kind of like old Romulan or I guess new Romulan birds of prey like flying in and out of the Borg cube was pretty cool and evocative.
Yeah.
I have no idea how they got a hold of this this synthetic girl, what she understands about her own existence, why they wanted to hunt down her sister, but they actually are using her. Is this the same faction of Romulans? I don't know.
Yeah, all good questions that we're not supposed to have answers to yet.
Yep.
I got other questions for you. Like, when do we see a Sisko or Janeway series? Because we're not going to see an Archer series for a while, right? Although, if you're going to do it, Scott Bakula was getting pretty old, too.
Also, he's, like, already dead. Like, that was a prequel series.
Well, you could set any of these series at any time.
Oh, I guess that's true. I guess that's true. I don't know. Also, would you see a Sisko? Because didn't he ascend into the prophets? Like, what would that look like? Him just chilling.
I can't remember if he still has a physical form.
Him just chilling in the wormhole with the Bajoran gods.
Yeah. I don't know. It'd be interesting to explore an entire
Star Trek emissary. He's just because it happens once a season that the Next Generation crew finds a life form that's on the cusp of ascending to some sort of Sylvanian man godhood. He's going to turn into an energy cloud or something. Like, what becomes of all these people? What becomes of all these people who are proto-Q?
They go back and they do their own thing. I mean, they tend to leave them alone at the end, like. They never take any of those beings with them.
My theory is that like every like post humanoid civilization eventually just merges with the Q. Like the Q is kind of like a fraternal order of demigod beings that just like, oh, you've transcended your human limitations and your paltry understandings of the fourth dimensions. Welcome to the continuum.
That's the thing. I watched the episode the other night where the Q first takes them out to meet the Borg.
Yeah.
To humiliate Patrick Stewart, humiliate the human race.
Right.
And he kept saying like, oh, there are things out there beyond your understanding, beyond your capability to deal with, when he is one of those things. Like, they've already met that thing.
Right.
And the purest form of it, it's like,
right.
Yeah, Picard, you should know you couldn't do anything against Q if you wanted to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a cue. It's like that episode, because I watched that recently too, and it's a little like Job spouting off to God, you know, a bit like he was a little foolhardy in how much I think all the crew is a little foolhardy in how much they tug on Q's cape from time to time.
Yeah,
it's a good thing that he somehow deep down likes humanity, or they would have just been they'd been killed a long time ago.
Yeah, and we haven't met the ones that would kill us.
Mm.
Also, are we going to get to see any Elkars in the show? Because I think that Elkars is one of the most all-time iconic user interfaces.
Here's the thing. I think we found in the 21st century that those types of mutable touch face screen designs, we don't want anywhere near like photon torpedo launching. Imagine if you're like how many typos you make, and imagine that's Worf trying to hail someone with the button right next to the photon torpedo launcher.
But now we got Minority Report shit where you're waving your hands in the air like Dodge was this episode. It's like, that's no better. That's even worse, honestly.
Yeah, it's less precise.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and plus, I just love Elkars.
It's a really cool. It's a very cool. I thought that was the future of design, and then I learned about like tactile feedback and how important that is to humans. Like, you know, like forming muscle memory for things. And I don't know, maybe that's why. The other thing I thought was interesting is one of the glaring kind of like weirdness to see, and this goes for almost all science fiction, it goes for the Star Wars, the Expanse, Star Trek, is how little automation seems to affect.
Yeah.
Like they actually have people going around cleaning the Enterprise. They have people steering the ship. and aiming the weapons devices on it when
right.
we already have machines right now that would do a better job of that than you'd think the 24th century equivalents.
And in some of those episodes, they specifically say, like, oh, this is a job that a human can't do fast enough. Well, you need to turn the ship over to the computer. And everybody's like, ooh, turn the ship over to the computer. I don't know.
Yeah, meanwhile, we're, like, starting to dip our toes with that with Tesla and whatnot.
Right.
And airliners and ships at sea and whatnot. But I thought it was cool to see, like, Chateau Picard actually has robots out there working the fields, you know, because of course they would.
Drones.
Yeah, you wouldn't need you wouldn't want people working out in the fields. You probably wouldn't get a lot of 24th century volunteers to pick the fucking Picard's grapes.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was neat. I wonder how that will like on a starship. You're always going to have some dudes or lady steering the ship. You're always going to have some person firing the guns, I guess, even though that's not realistic. But it's nice to see a little bit of that automation. You got flying cars. The Golden Gate Bridge was all solar panels. Did you notice that?
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah, the highway system was just interlocking lattices of solar panels.
Okay.
That's pretty cool.
The idea has been floated around, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's 24th century. They got it ready to go.
Yeah, a little weird because you're underneath objects most of the time.
Yeah.
Getting a traffic jam on that.
It looked like there was zero
traffic
on it. Like, also, there's some kind of blend of flying cars. And
I mean, when you have teleporters,
that
tech would render cars almost useless.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could transport any goods you wanted, any people, whatever.
It's amazing people walk anywhere, honestly.
Yeah. I don't have anything else. I'm looking forward to episode 2, see where they take this thing with its themes and its story.
Mm-hmm.
See what Patrick Stewart can do. I don't know. How did you feel about Patrick Stewart and his performance during this?
I thought that's the other thing I forgot to mention in the DNA. Like, this is got a lot of Logan in it, too. The idea that Picard is an old man. Yeah. Like, he was never an action hero, but he's not going to be, you know, swinging from the engines of the Enterprise, duking it out with the Borg Queen.
Mm-hmm.
He's not going to be, you know, fighting off a Gorn soldier or whatever. He's like, there was a lot of action scenes, but he played a frightened old man that could not do anything. Like, if it wasn't for this potential Data daughter, he would have been a red mist in some Romulan disruptor. So I like it. That vulnerability that he's playing, you know, like at the end, I hope Patrick Stewart lives another 10, 15, 20 years. But the reality is he is towards the end of his life, and he's bringing that. This seems to have. This project seems to have really unlocked his passion, and he never really slummed it on Star Trek. Even when stuff wasn't great, he was made it watchable, and when things were really awesome, he made it amazing. And I like to see him bring that energy. I was surprised at how, because he really played into shakiness in Logan, for example, when he's playing old Professor X. I was surprised at how strong he sounded. Like his voice sounds a lot like the Picard that I've always known. I was expecting to be a little bit more old man Picard. He seemed very vigorous, dynamic.
I mean, the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, this is a very old man trying to, you know, bring out what made his character so distinctive before, and it didn't quite work for me the first time, but I think I settled in, and on second and third watches I was very much feeling the Picard in this. And I'm hoping that as he gets stuff that is, you know, more things to do that are assertive, more things to do that are important in this series, that he'll be able to bring that to it in even greater terms. But, like, I thought it was pretty good.
Okay.
He was pretty good. Pretty good.
I thought he was pretty nice. He's pretty good.
Yeah.
He's great. And honestly, this show, like that's the thing, is like Star Trek the Next Generation was cover your eyes bad, awful for like the first season and a half. This show came out of the gate pretty damn good. It's not the best television I've seen, because there's been some really, I don't know if you guys have been watching the last 10 years or so, but there's been some pretty good television on. But is out of the gate probably the most confident and well put together Star Trek I've seen in the last 15 years, probably, you know, because even Deep Space Nine didn't make it out of the gate completely, You know, they needed some kind of shakedown cruise. And I think it also helps that you're not trying to introduce 12 people like previous Star Treks are. It's like, oh, let's go find the first officer. Now let's see the doctor. And, oh, I wonder which kind of weird alien's going to be in this. You know, you had Picard and he had to meet like one or two other people. And it seems now he's going to assemble a team and they're going to say, you son of a bitch, I'm in. And everything will be engage and warp here and warp there. But like, it gets a slower start and that's a good thing.
I think so.
Yeah. And even with a slow start, also had like pretty big, you know, jaw dropping set piece action things. Anything you're hoping to see this season? I wouldn't mind seeing some outer space action. Like, that's what I like. You know, it's cool seeing them doing the human monkey bars routine where people are like doing the hand to hand combat. But I would like to see some ship to ship stuff. I love to see an expanse. I like to see Star Trek do that again.
I've seen the This Season On preview, and I don't want to say anything about it because I know some people consider those spoilers or maybe avoiding them.
Yeah.
But there are some things that are in that I'm very much looking forward to, specifically as it regards a character that might show up again.
There's a few
characters. And it's probably not the one you're thinking of.
Oh, see, because I've got, like, there's a few characters in the Season On that I think look exciting to come up with. I think that, there's a couple compelling, I think, ship-to-ship battles in Disco. Mm-hmm. But they were like the new Trek, like where just everything's on fire and the camera's spinning around and like shit shooting everywhere and there's explosions. Like I kind of want some understated.
I mean, that's just the modern aesthetic, man. That's what I wonder. Like, can this show stand up to the modern Star Trek aesthetic?
Well, the state of the art is The Expanse. The Expanse is very gripping, well done space science fiction combat where
they're not going to do crash couches and inertia and zero gravity. They're not going to do any of that.
But as far as like The Expanse is not like 100 ships firing 30 proton torpedoes all the time and the camera spinning through. It's like the Jason Bourne of ship to ship combat. Mm-hmm. I would like to see some of that in Picard, but I don't know. Maybe it's not going to be that type of show.
Yeah, we'll see.
Got a Borg cube in it. There should be some space battles.
All right, I think that's it.
If you care to send us feedback, we have a special hotline for that. It's Picard@baldmove.com. Mm-hmm. We'll be considering feedback as it comes into us starting next week if we get any. And you can also, of course, follow along everywhere that we are at Bald Move on all the social medias. With that said, that's it for this week. We'll be back around for the next episode next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.